The 1998 season had been rough so far for the Carolina Panthers. I was the quarterback's coach on the team, and we had lost the first five games to open the season. The sixth game was against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in Tampa, and it was a must-win. Everyone was feeling tremendous pressure. Steve Berline was our quarterback at the time, and he was leading us on a two-minute drive at the end of the game. We were down 16-13, so a field goal would tie it and send it to overtime. We were battling a young, rapidly improving Tampa defense that included four or five future Hall of Famers. It was tough sledding. Trips right, two-jet all-go special, X-dagger, was the call I gave Berline over his headset. He executed flawlessly. Off a five-step drop, Steve pumped the seam ball to Rocket Ishmael on his right. He moved the middle linebacker on the famous Tampa 2 coverage, and they opened up a hole. He had a quick reset of his feet, and he found Mohsin Muhammad in a huge window on his left just behind future Hall of Famer Derrick Brooks and in front of future Hall of Famer John Lynch. Moose caught the ball quickly, went to the ground, and Steve called a timeout. We were well within field goal range, and our reliable kicker, John Casey, trotted out onto the field as my mind turned towards formulating an overtime plan. The snap and hold were good, and as the kick went up, it hooked left, and the Panthers lost the game, dropping to 0-6. At a post-game press conference, Casey said that the wind had suddenly changed and that God must not have wanted the Panthers to win that day. A growing rift across religious lines was already developing on our team, and Casey's comments didn't help. A group of evangelical players on the team, I'm sure, agreed with John's assessment. God didn't want the Panthers to win, but another group was furious. I remember three players specifically bringing me the newspaper at the next day's morning meeting. They were flat out pissed. "How about you don't blame God and just do your job?" one exclaimed. "So does God not want me to keep my job?" he asked. "Hey, Casey's gotten paid already. He doesn't have to worry. Me? I need to win." Our team was becoming more divided along religious lines. Morale was poor.
So John Casey's comment showed up in the Charlotte paper that week. And the following Sunday at our church, a progressive congregation, the pastor asked me to get a message to John Casey. "You tell him," I said, "God does not care about football. She's a baseball fan." Now, he said it jokingly, but this clever turn of phrase actually pointed to a very real conundrum in football, and really in the world of sports in general. That playful question of whether God really cares about football or not carries with it a bigger question about the nature of faith and how communities make room for the mysteries of faith and for the dangerous capacity that faith has to be used as a tool of manipulation. Welcome to Going Deep. Sports in the 21st Century from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
We're Team Shoup, and we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond sound bites and highlight reels. Today, on Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, Faith, Force, and Football. How an all-out blitz and a few gadget plays have resulted in dominating control of locker rooms and the field of play for Christian groups that evangelize a particular brand of Christianity in sports.
It's a story of great marketing and a very effective use of a potent platform. but it's also a story of a power play that can leave young people at a very formative time in their lives feeling like their faith needs to conform to this dominating template in order for them to succeed, both at football and at life.
Not only did this faith monopoly create issues for us as Christians who were more progressive and open to religious difference, but through my years in coaching, I also experienced the diminishing returns of this monopoly for players, for teams, even for Christianity itself. TJ, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Hey, TJ.
How are you?
Good. How are you? I see that you're expecting a new bambino.
Oh, yeah. Number two is on.
That's TJ Yates. He's one of my favorite all-time quarterbacks. I coached him at the University of North Carolina, and he's now entering his seventh year in the NFL. Presently, he's with the Buffalo Bills.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely very prominent. You know, it was a thing that is kind of just a way of all of football, really. You know, no matter where you go in the pros and college, even in high school, it's a very prominent thing, kind of no matter where you go, college, pros, high school, anywhere. And it's something that's definitely always there, whether you're, a very big religious person, whether you're not religious at all, whether you're Jewish, Muslim, whatever you prefer, evangelical Christianity is definitely, it's all over the place in football.
Hey, Tom, welcome to Going Deep.
Thank you very much for reaching out to me. I'm really impressed with the work that you and John are doing and what an important voice you've been raising.
Thank you.
In the area of ethics and big-time sports.
Your book, Onward Christian Athletes, was a really important thing for me, not just for my work, but as a human being.
My name is Tom Krottenmaker. I am a writer specializing in religion and public life. By day, I am communications director at Yale Divinity School. My other main affiliation is USA Today. I'm a contributing columnist for them, and I have been for over a decade. The evangelical movement in the United States, which is what's been driving Christianity and sports now for quite a while and dominating it, is a very masculine sort of movement. Not that there aren't women and women voices, but I think anybody who observes American Christianity in the past few decades would acknowledge that almost all of the strongest voices and leaders in evangelical America, to a fault, are male voices, and there's a very strong emphasis on traditional male and female roles, men as the head of the household, men as the boss. And we can see echoes of this in the kind of Christian engagement in sports that has been going on. But you talked about evangelism and the role there. That's really, to me, been the driving imperative since Christianity re-engaged with sports, if you will, probably in the middle of the 20th century. It's interesting to look at a kind of backing away or falling away that happened in the late 19th century, driven by people like Billy Sunday, a name that I know you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. You know, this baseball star who then became a Christian and became very critical of professional baseball and of sports as a proper venue for Christianity. And that sort of paralleled a falling away that happened and then continued for many decades, paralleled too by what happened with the Scopes Monkey Trial and evangelical withdrawal from politics and contemporary life. This is all very reductive, but there's truth to this arc that occurred over that half century or so. But then, as we know, Christian engagement with sports came back strong around the World War II era. And as we alluded to earlier, evangelism became more and more the emphasis. Not the character that you could develop through playing sports, but the usefulness of sports as a vehicle for conveying the Christian message, especially a theologically conservative Christian message.
The way I see it, you got to give evangelical Christianity some credit. I mean, they have worked hard to get in every locker room at every level in the country. And as Tom said, they out-hustled other faith traditions.
So that term evangelical is actually a lot more complicated than it can sound when we use it as a label for a certain group or a certain brand of Christianity. All Christians are evangelicals because that just means we feel called to share our faith, and that's part of being a Christian. I wish we had a finer point to add to what it is that this particular expression of Christianity carries with it. There's not a neat label for it. It's embedded in the work of parachurch movements like FCA and Athletes in Action. It has definitely a kind of orientation to Scripture that it's not fundamentalist, but it's also not steeped in a history of kind of academic study of Scripture. A lot of the chaplains that are placed in these programs are not seminary trained. And so there is a particular way in which Christianity has gotten, you know, kind of marketed using this platform. And they have been very effective. And I do think that part of their effectiveness is that progressive Christians, or Christians who lead less with that kind of evangelical impulse, just sort of ceded that territory to Christians who felt more compelled to spread the faith. So if you have urgency about getting more Christians under your, you know, kind of on your little tally sheet, sports is a great atmosphere to capitalize on some pretty potent and intense relationships. But if that's not the way you lead with your faith, that you want to get more people signed up on the Christian roles, then, you know, maybe sports isn't as a compelling space.
And they recognized that America was becoming increasingly obsessed with sports, the spectator culture, the emergence of athletes as celebrities. And I guess to their credit, they saw that this was sort of a marketing opportunity. And I say that not to be snarky or negative. They were right about that.
Tom, you're right. And onward, Christian athletes, you're right. It's telling that FCA representatives and their fellow sports world faith promoters so frequently use the language and logic of marketing. It hints at the treatment of Christian faith as something akin to a product, something to be promoted by the most effective means possible. Talk about some of those means, and they may be simple things, but very intentional, from praying in the end zone. Everybody in this generation knows about Tebowing, but boy, that started a long time ago, didn't it?
Sure. And as I have said many times, it's, yes, natural that somebody would express gratitude in this really exciting moment of success and pressure. I mean, it's natural then to maybe, if you're a Christian, to thank God, either through your gestures or your language. And so I don't want to be overly negative about that. And I know from interviews and research that, to a degree, the chaplains that are embedded with these teams have encouraged athletes to do it. You could even say that they put them up to it.
So you were playing around the same time that Tim Tebow was sort of a iconic figure of how a player could use sports as a platform for his faith. And I remember some of the times when things were still kind of getting off the ground at Carolina, that there was a kind of rumbling among some people with the football program that our team should be more Christian. we should use this opportunity more as a platform, and that kind of Tim Tebow was the model for that. Do you remember that? The specter of Tebow kind of sitting out in front of you?
Absolutely. That's a hard thing for anybody to forget, because he was such a big figure in college sports, and you know, not only because he was such a great player, but because he was so outward with his faith. Whether it was, I mean, Tebowing, the word Tebowing came from him kneeling and praying in the end zone after he scored a touchdown. That's what it all came from. You know, that was kind of the big thing in college. Was, I think we were around the same time playing. And so that was kind of the model that,
right,
you know, most teams wanted to kind of model their team after.
I recall a conversation I had with a pro basketball chaplain who said that he really encouraged the players to start this practice of huddling at center at midcourt after the game, holding hands and doing a very public prayer. Yes, I mean, praying comes naturally to a Christian athlete, but it was the chaplain who was influencing them to do it in public and to sort of make a point by doing that and get attention. And that's part and parcel with what we've discussed about the imperative to evangelize and to use the big-time sports venue as a way to get Christianity seen and considered.
Yes, and I want to just from experience take that even a step forward. I wouldn't say that it's just encouragement. I would use the word pressure.
And pressure.
Yes, and I have seen in several situations where chaplains who really have no accountability, you know, they're placed in state schools by Athletes in Action or sometimes FCA, but they don't have any university accountability, but yet they have access.
Free access is such a huge factor to
the athletes. They're on team planes, they're at practices, they're at the meal times and things. And so not only are they kind of helping to frame, like, well, here's how you use sports as a platform for your religious, for your faith. Here's how you kind of properly give the glory to God. But we have seen chaplains who target, like, okay, there's the quarterback. Everybody at this university is going to listen to the quarterback. He's not really a Christian, but I'm going to strike up a conversation with him. I'm going to build a relationship with him. I'm going to take him on mission trips. And I'm going to kind of groom him into being a spokesperson for this because he's in a prominent position on this team. We've seen that. And we've seen players who have, you know, kind of innocently followed along with that and become a real kind of instrument of the whole program in terms of the FCA or Athletes in Action. And then we've seen players who weren't comfortable with that and who kind of got, you know, blackballed, for want of a better term, from the kind of, you know, in group of FCA or the players who were religious. So it's not just encouragement and it's not just framing. It's also this very kind of intentional strategizing about what players would be their most potent advocates for what they're doing.
That is so interesting. Such a great point. And it calls to mind marketing. Mm-hmm. What you're describing, Marcia, makes perfect sense from a marketing standpoint. You're trying to get attention. There's this tradition of celebrity endorsements. I mean, just setting Christianity aside for a minute, for many decades now, advertisers have used prominent athletes and other celebrities to sell products. So it makes perfect sense from that standpoint. And it calls to mind what I consider to be the deep tension between the values of marketing on one hand and of Christianity on the other. Or to put it another way, Christianity is not just another product out there that we want to use the tools of marketing to promote. It can be very problematic.
I think Marcia makes a very real point about team chaplains having incredible access.
And access is so valuable. Think about all the people who would love to have access to those star athletes. What I'm remembering is sort of an online correspondence that a Catholic guy struck up with me when I was doing this research, and he was expressing his frustration over his inability to get access. Access is a word that you've been using a few times, John, and it's a good one. But this Catholic leader was trying to get going on the sports ministry front, and he was not getting very far in terms of access to teams and players. And he wouldn't go on the record with me for the book, but he told me that he was getting the Heisman stiff arm when he was trying to get in there to try to bring a Catholic perspective to bear on what was going on with sports ministry. And as we know, Catholics have a lot in common with evangelicals. But in terms of social thought and social practice, they are significantly different, too. And we also know that some of the more extremist voices in evangelical Christianity have talked about Catholicism as being, you know, not properly Christian.
Yeah.
So that's very problematic as well.
The last team that I coached on, we had evangelical Christians, we had progressive Christians, we had Jewish players, we had Muslim players, we had agnostics and atheists. Yet the only faith tradition that had access to all of our players at team meals, in the locker room, in meetings, was this evangelical brand of Christianity through the parachurch of FCA and Athletes in Action.
Well, in that situation, I think we could say that there was open access given to a representative of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes.
Yes.
And that representative of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes was someone who could seem to players to be maybe an employee of the university. They went on team trips. They were in the locker room. They were at meals. They were sort of omnipresent. They have free access. And so, again, at a state university, and the university wasn't paying him to be there.
Correct.
But yet, there was the appearance that he had, you know, kind of sanction of the university. Nobody else had all that access to everybody who was a representative of a religious group.
Correct.
So that kind of access is a form of approval. It's a form of empowerment.
It certainly is.
And so the state university was empowering that particular expression of Christianity, which, again, I don't want to use evangelical. I'd like to use something else. So many of the terms that we put on in front of Christian just don't capture what we're talking about. What we're talking about here is someone who was not seminary trained. Again, that doesn't mean he's not a faithful person. It just means that's a particular way of encountering the scriptures and the tradition. Embedded also in that particular expression of Christianity are some assumptions about gender.
Very much so.
You don't see a lot of women chaplains for the FCA placed in universities. In fact, I think up until a few years ago, the FCA had almost no female kind of dispatched representatives on university campuses. So it's embedded in there are some assumptions about gender, some assumptions about, you know, how our intellect is supposed to interface with our faith. And there are also within that some assumptions about what it means to be a good Christian, that social justice is not the leading kind of edge of what it means to be a faithful Christian, but that getting as many people as you can to become a Christian is a way to be a faithful Christian, and to use every opportunity and platform you have to name that. Also, again, those aren't necessarily bad things, but the university is signaling a kind of institutional level of approval by letting that brand of Christianity have free access to young men and in their late teens and early 20s who have a lot of questions about life. And here's the person standing right in front of them to give them some answers. I mean, we had come from the NFL when we got to UNC. I just remember we were no stranger to the way this particular brand of Christianity, you know, pretty much had a foothold in its official status and the way chaplains were placed and things like that. But because University of North Carolina was a state school, I remember being surprised that the school kind of allowed this brand of Christianity to just kind of be embedded on the team. Now I know that that's just kind of the norm. It's like that everywhere. I wonder, as a player coming in, did you wonder about that? Like, is this the North Carolina University of North Carolina's chaplain, or did you have a way of framing that that was somebody from the FCA and not from the university? Or,
I mean, it was just kind of the way it was. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't know any different, and I don't think anybody coming in knew any different either. Because, you know, the way the trickle-down effect as well as college sports, you know, goes into high school sports, that was kind of the same in high school sports as well.
Hmm.
So, you know, you kind of just go into college. Obviously, you know, young 18-year-old kids coming into college, their head's spinning as much as it is, and they kind of just kind of go along with it. But that was just kind of the norm. You know, chapel and mass, you know, before, there wasn't ever any different types of religions really offered throughout college, but it's just kind of the way it was, and that's kind of the norm.
One of the reasons that this particular brand of faith fits so well in the world of football specifically is because there's clear lines drawn. Who's in, who's out. How to do it, how not to do it. Football also has that militaristic sense of, we got to deal in black and white. There can't be any gray area. Whereas other faith traditions, in my faith, I deal deeply in the world of gray. I feel like everything is ambiguous. Everything is connected. Where I think that the particular brand of Christianity that some of those parachurch movements bring to the world of football specifically, because that's where we've lived for the last quarter century, has such clear lines drawn that it makes being a soldier easier.
Yes, it makes being a soldier easier, and it fits with that kind of mentality of don't ask questions, just accept it. This is the way it is,
yes.
And here's the way to be dutiful. The interesting thing to me, again, is if we zoom out and we look at the universities where this is what's happening on its sports teams.
Understand, I think an important thing to understand, this is happening at every university.
Every major football program has a chaplain there embedded from the FCA or Athletes in Action.
Yes.
Okay, that's happening. But if you zoom out and you look at the religious life on the larger campus, the university is committed to providing resources for all different kinds of students. They might have a Newman Center for Catholic students. They might have a Jewish, Jewish student group. They might have all kinds of different chaplains on campus, a Methodist, a Presbyterian, a Baptist. And the university has obvious value vested in this kind of diverse approach to providing spiritual support for players and for students on its campus. But then the sports venue is treated differently. And to me, this is another example of how athletes are sort of a special class of people on campus. They can't be trusted. to have the same college experience as everyone else, which includes questions about your faith, experimenting with different ideas, maybe not looking at faith much at all during your 4 years, 5 years of college or whatever, but that somehow we have to control the athletic situation, including their minds, including their spirituality in a way that keeps them in line, you know, keeps them on the straight and narrow, so that that whole area just won't be a problem area. It'll just do what we need it to do, which is make the university a lot of money. It just strikes me that the rest of the campus has this more kind of empowering model around spirituality, and then the athletic department has a shut up, this is the way you should do it, and here is what we're going to provide for you to how you make from how you make sense of that. That bothers me.
I broached the topic one time with a coach that I worked for at a state university of, are we allowed to be evangelizing as much as this staff seems to be at a state university? His response to me was, well, I'm going to consider this an act of civil disobedience because I feel called to really share my faith with all the members of our team. And I think it's interesting what you said. There's a power dynamic there. It's not just evangelism. There's something that feels insincere, unauthentic to me when a player is compelled to believing something in that power differential.
Well, and also the whole use of the word, the whole, you know, kind of appealing to civil disobedience is interesting to me, because civil disobedience is about standing up to an abusive power, something that has more power than you. So I'm going to stand up against that, to challenge its oppressive power. A lot of times it's an issue of conscience. That's what civil disobedience is. And it's interesting to me to use that term in this, because you are invading someone's conscience when you kind of dictate what their faith tradition should be, using your power to compel that in someone. That's not civil disobedience. That is abusing your power. You've used your power to invade someone's conscience, override their conscience, and tell them that they need to conform so that blah, 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 blah. And I know in at least one setting that you've been in, a coach actually said in front of the players, we would be a better team if everybody followed Jesus. That is not civil disobedience.
That's unethical behavior.
Well, unethical is one word for it. I would use, and I question how that compelling of someone to your faith is an act of faith. People see that as an act of faith, but really, is it an act of faith? Because faith is about trusting God. Do we not trust God enough to be moving in a person's life? That do we think we're the ones that had to fix that for somebody? An act of faith would be for me to believe that what I need to do is be a loving person, be an ethical person, don't apologize for my faith, let it lead the way in my life, and trust God with the rest.
As a pastor, you often say, let God do God's work.
Well, and that's part of, I feel like, the loss that other expressions of Christianity haven't been more involved in sports. You know, sports are about relationships. They're about close communities where people have a common sense of purpose. And I wish Christians took up more space in that as Christians, so that we would experience the strength of community in a way that that strengthened our faith, that God was at work even in these spaces where, you know, people had different ideas, people came from different perspectives. I feel like Christianity is, it's a real gift when it can find a way to love people in the midst of those kind of differences.
I was in a comical situation a few weeks ago where I was in a coach's Bible study, and the coach was complaining that there was a high school coach in Georgia who had been fired for praying on the field and with the team. And I asked that coach, well, how would you feel if it was a faith tradition different than your own that was leading the prayers? And he said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, what if the head coach turned everybody towards Mecca and forced the entire team to pray a Muslim prayer? And he sat there for about 10 seconds and looked at me and said, well, that's not what I'm talking about. And he couldn't even go there. It didn't even make sense to him what I was saying. The one thing I'd like to say...
This is such an important point. This is what's going on in politics in our country, too. This is the cultural moment we've been going through in this country, in sports and way outside of sports, too. It's this tension and this battle between the growing religious pluralism and acceptance of different faiths and people without faith, on one hand, and traditional, theologically conservative Christianity and Christians, on the other hand. And if you just unpack the kinds of stories you've been telling, if you just unpack what's been happening in sports, you have kind of the whole story about what's going on in politics in the United States as well. Even though I was not a collegiate athlete, I had that experience myself in my interactions with Campus Crusade. You know, I was raised Catholic, and my dad in particular was very committed to the Catholic faith and wanted very badly for me to remain a Catholic. Yet I remember being a sophomore in college having a meeting with a Campus Crusade guy who was telling me that Catholicism was wrong and that I needed to reconvert into being an evangelical Christian. And I kept thinking, I wonder what my dad would think of this. I think we can agree he would not have been pleased. I don't think I discussed those conversations with him. What I worry about is perhaps the inability or unwillingness of the promoter to meet somebody on his or her own terms.
Yes.
Like, what if somebody's a Jew or a Muslim or somebody who follows a more progressive stream of Christianity? Is the chaplain then going to encourage that path and try to make it as good as possible, or try to do a deconversion and reconversion? These are important questions.
If we go back to your point about that Christianity isn't just another product, you know, Christianity isn't just toothpaste. It's
not just toothpaste.
It's your faith. It's your inner consciousness. It's your sense of self. It's your, you know, it's a really personal thing.
And it's countercultural in really important ways, too, if one is going to be serious about this way of Jesus.
Yes. And to think that, again, I really don't want to make this into a bashing or a, you know, kind of let's rake FCA over the coals or anything like that. But I do think there's an ethical, really sharp edge here around kind of capitalizing on this particular space. And sports is unique in that there are very real power hierarchies in sports. And if you insert religion and the kind of cajoling of becoming an adopter of a religion into those power dynamics, it seems to me we've got a different kind of ethical dilemma than maybe in any other situation that I can
dilemma is
think
the
of.
Right word, Marcia.
My question here is, why haven't progressive Christians been more moved to get involved in sports arenas as Christians because of social justice issues? And for me, as a progressive Christian, that's where I wish Christians took up more space in sports, is there are lots of justice issues around abuse of power, around race, around gender, around economic justice. Why don't progressive Christians care about that? And as a progressive Christian as well, I feel troubled by the way young people who are, you know, trusting themselves in these relationships that aren't equal, in other words, coaches, athletic directors, academic advisors, people like that, they have power over athletes, and especially in state schools, when faith is folded into those relationships in which the person with more power uses his position to cajole a person into appropriating their faith. I have a problem with that as a Christian, not just as, you know, somebody who doesn't think state schools should do it, but as a Christian, I have trouble with that.
Thanks, TJ. Really appreciate you coming on Going Deep. Keep up the good work, and you got a chance to, you got a real good chance, you know, to make this team. So
we're praying for you.
Keep making a living.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Give your family our love, please.
All right. You guys do the same.
Okay. Take care.
I'll talk to you soon, brother. Bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Thanks, Tom. We really appreciate you.
Thank you very much for reaching out to me.
You want to write part two?
Yeah, maybe
I'll share
a sequel.
Some stories that'll knock your socks off. You'll be like, that didn't
stories
really
that
happen.
Would knock my socks off, huh?
Yeah, that really happened. I can promise you. I was in the room when that happened. You're listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, on Blue Ridge Public Radio, which is the NPR station for all of Western North Carolina.
The Spirit is generous when we open ourselves up to the way God moves in those situations. You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.